Chapter 10. History Rhymes. The man who is admired for the ingenuity of his larceny is almost always rediscovering some earlier form of fraud. The basic forms are all known, have all been practiced. The manners of capitalism improve. The morals may not. John Kenneth Galbraith, economist and author. More than 100 years before COVID, the great influenza brought death and the spoils that follow in its wake. Racistly dubbed the Spanish flu and contemporaneously referred to as the grip, the H1N1 influenza A strain caught the United States on its heels as it waged an expensive and exhausting war in Europe. Supplies and food were already being rationed to support the Great War effort. Restaurants and food halls, essential to many city dwellers, faced federal scrutiny over price hikes created by both diminished food supply and advantageous greed. Government orders to vacate public spaces and to wear homemade gauze masks were the subject of localized controversies and resistance. Spiking infections and deaths wrought fear and desperation for protection, remedies, and information. Crooks saw their opening. A Brooklyn pharmacist named Joseph M.G. Tuke sold flu patients thousands of boxes of aspirin tablets, marketed as a remedy. Even if aspirin could treat more than flu symptoms, the pills he sold weren't aspirin at all, but rather a cheap and dangerous compound of mostly talcum powder, cornstarch, and an unstable acid. Tuke was caught and sentenced to a $500 fine and 3 years in prison. When the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle reported his sentence, the headline curiously referred to Tuke as an influenza pirate. An advertisement printed in the Kansas City Times just before the 1918 Christmas holiday warned readers of the dangers and high transmissibility of the virus, saying, "It is the duty of every man, woman, and child to do everything in their power to keep well and prevent further spreading of such a dangerous disease." The advertisement resembled a news story, explaining for several frightful paragraphs the symptoms and characteristics of the illness, before offering to customers an exciting remedy: snake oil. Hundreds of letters and testimonials from all over the country tend to prove that Miller's antiseptic oil, known as snake oil, has already prevented the spread of influenza, and this had no doubt saved many lives. By then, snake oil had been marketed for more than a century as a panacea, on street corners and in stores, in countless iterations, and with some vendors using the moniker to mask elixirs containing addictive drugs like cocaine, amphetamines, and opiates. Those potions and their sale had already become synonymous with hucksters and quackery in the early 20th century with the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906 and new federal regulation. Yet snake oil was flying off drugstore shelves a decade later. To the left of the snake oil ad in the Kansas City Times, another company marketed in bold letters a drug called laxative bromoquinine, claiming it keeps one's system in condition to throw off attacks of colds, grip, and influenza. The tablets, marketed by entrepreneur Edwin Wiley Grove, had been around for a couple of decades as a treatment for colds and would become widely marketed as an actual cure for the flu, though people who believed the latter were shitting themselves. Grove was a self-made pharmaceutical mogul and puffery genius whose products bore his signature as a gesture of authenticity to consumers. His two most popular products, including his tasteless chill tonic, combined the bitter and hard-to-swallow anti-malarial drug quinine with other elements to produce a more palatable drug to combat fever and chills. It was a legitimate innovation, even if its benefits were overblown. On a smaller scale, unscrupulous doctors sought their own fortunes. The Ohio State Medical Board received thousands of complaints about doctors and nurses charging exorbitant fees for treating patients suffering from the flu. in Nebraska, the Omaha Daily Bee ran an above-the-fold dispatch titled, "Omaha Doctors Coining Money Off People's Misery." In castigating doctors for charging as much as $10 to treat patients, the city's health commissioner offered a local reporter fabulous quotes that would be unthinkable in today's staid bureaucratic culture. Some of the doctors who are getting plenty of practice for the first time in their lives in the present Spanish influenza crisis are proving themselves nothing but human vultures. I'm going after those fellows if they don't stop it. In Tampa, Florida, journalists noted that the citrus industry, poised to charge inflationary prices for fruits, was a good stock buy. "We are advised that fruit retailers are taking advantage of the epidemic of influenza to profiteer to a very great degree, especially on oranges and lemons, both of which are badly needed," the Tampa Daily Times wrote in October 1918. Reports of pandemic profiteering coalesced with broader frustration surrounding shortages of basic household items limited by rations and exports for the war effort. Many of the nation's grocers, restaurants, and mills, which newspapers from Chicago to Selma and San Francisco dubbed food pirates, were hoarding goods such as sugar and wheat and selling them at obscene markups, sometimes double the price. The concerns were widespread enough that the Justice Department stepped in to regulate prices and prosecute price gougers. By December 1919, federal law enforcement had identified more than 200 food pirates and pursued criminal charges in about half of those cases. Perhaps the vilest example of profiteering seen over several waves of the great influenza, from 1918 to 1920, was that of the coffin trusts. Influenza would take some 675,000 Americans. And as the bodies stacked up, many U.S. cities experienced devastating shortages of containers in which to bury their dead. In West Haven, Connecticut, for example, the body of a dead woman was left to deteriorate in a house for 7 days while the family's undertaker searched for a casket. The shortage was most troubling in larger cities such as Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., where some undertakers banded together to fix and raise funeral costs. As Dorothy Ann Petit wrote in A Cruel Wind, her 1976 dissertation on the Great Influenza, the problem seemed twofold: the short supply and the high rates being charged by some unscrupulous believers in free enterprise. Evidently, more than a few undertakers thought that raising their funeral charges during the pandemic was only part of the natural law. The cost of living in Washington was already high, as an influx of wartime workers had overcrowded the city and its housing supply. But now, the cost of living paled by comparison to the cost of dying. Families could not afford to bury their dead. As with most scams, it was the poor and vulnerable who suffered most. At one point, the city had so many dead it couldn't keep count. Washington's newspapers couldn't keep up with traditional obituaries, opting instead to list only prominent Washingtonians taken by the flu. Many D.C. residents embraced public health measures like wearing masks, but it had already overtaken the city. On one Black Saturday, more than 1,300 people were found to be infected, and 92 died. Cops and federal government workers were out sick. It became a crime to cough and sneeze in public, punishable by steep fines. Schools closed. The city opened 2 emergency hospitals. But for all the bureaucratic and medical measures officials could take to address the crushing wave of deaths, there was simply nowhere to put the corpses. To secure coffins, the city's top health official publicly attacked those who had raised the price of funerals. Such preying on unfortunate families in this direful time is nothing short of ghoulish in spirit and unpatriotic to the point of treason, Dr. William Fowler told the Washington Post in October 1918. City leaders protected their people at the expense of other cities, at one point hijacking a train shipment of caskets en route to Pittsburgh, which experienced arguably the worst sustained beating of the 1918 pandemic. Much was the same as the virus spread to other states and cities, where local leaders each experienced their own versions of hell, made different only by their proximate political and cultural forces. It is tempting to judge the rampant stupidity and blatant profiteering of the past, but the thrill fades upon further inspection of our present. Parallels abound between COVID-19 and the flu that killed between 20 and 50 million people worldwide a century before. In both times, people were shot and killed during conflicts over mask mandates. In both times, local officials fought with state governors over business closures and mask requirements. Governors fought the federal government, invoking states' rights. Theaters and restaurants became flashpoints for public angst. In both times, hospitals were overrun. Medical staff died, bodies piled up with nowhere to put them. In both eras, we had presidents who embraced white supremacists. In both times, people looked to an anti-malarial drug for salvation, despite a lack of scientific evidence. It is remarkable that hydroxychloroquine, falsely touted by the Trump administration as a cure-all, was discovered by scientists trying to synthesize a drug that was similar to the naturally occurring quinine contained in Grove's laxative bromoquinine. Our blind adoption of these pharmaceutical relatives 100 years apart says something about our gullibility when a plague we don't understand starts killing our kin. Robert Stewart's invocation of pirates as we journeyed across an infected country in search of masks seemed odd and anachronistic at first, but it somehow ties neatly back to the shenanigans exhibited a century before, when both literal sea pirates and the profiteering kind shared headline space in American newspapers. As I attempted to reconcile the schemes I was chasing in real time against those stored in the torn and yellowed pages of our past, I began to feel that perhaps we are doomed to repeat history. It was all there, in textbooks and the Library of Congress and various online archives. We knew everything, yet it seemed we had learned nothing.